Thank you, everyone, for sharing your thoughts. So now I'm going to hand it over to Paul, who is going to introduce our guest today and then start with the conversation that we have all been waiting for. So over to you, Paul.
Thank you, Kanchan. And thank you, Jake, for being with us. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I know everybody else is too, and that was a great start to it. For those that may have joined a little bit late, I'll just bear with me, Jake. I'm going to run through a little bit of your resume so people can fill in some of the blanks. But Jake seems like a perfect fit for what Service Space is about and what these conversations often deal with. As Kanchan mentioned, Jake is founder of Nuru International. He founded it in 2008. And it's a nonprofit that has been working largely in Africa or solely in Africa to date. And it's dedicated to a very ambitious goal, which is to end extreme poverty. And I think we'll talk a little bit about what extreme poverty is and what that term means. But before founding Nuru, Jake got an MBA at Stanford. And before that, Jake was in the military and was a decorated soldier, awarding a Bronze Star for his service to the country in Iraq. And I think what we'll find, hopefully, in the conversation with Jake is that Jake's story is a fascinating one in one measure because of what he's doing, but also in large measure because of how he came to be doing it. And I think that's what makes these conversations so rich, is the path and the journey that we are all on. And Jake's has been particularly interesting. So, Jake, it's great to have you here. We so much appreciate you participating.
Thank you very much. I just want to say that I'm very humbled to be on the call today and to be able to talk with and learn from you all. It's a real honor, so thanks for the opportunity.
So, Jake, let's talk just at the outset here about the trajectory, in a sense, of how you came to be doing what you're doing. And you know, those who have read any of the background material here know that there was a fairly dramatic turn of events in your life that put you on this path. So why don't you describe that that event, that moment for us, as it seems like a good place to start.
Sure. So I was a special operations Marine in my former life. And during the invasion, the Iraqi invasion in 2003, we were one of the leading units in the Marine Corps, kind of pushing up through the south. And in southern Iraq, it was one of the poorest places in the world at the time. There was no access to clean water, healthcare services. There was a real hunger, food insecurity problem. And what had been happening as we advanced north was the regular Iraqi army had been retreating to make a final stand in Baghdad. Meanwhile, Saddam had been pushing his special forces soldiers, they're called Fedayeen, south into these southern regions. And they were basically going hut to hut in these rural villages, coercing poor farmers to come and fight us. You know, basically saying, your children are starving right in front of you. We will drop a bag of rice off here, you know, every 2 weeks if you'll pick up this weapon and go fight these guys 10 miles south of here, or strap a bomb to yourself and go blow yourself up in their position. And we were fighting these guys by the hundreds and thousands. And so that kind of set the stage for what happened in this one particular instance. And I ended up having several experiences like this over time, unfortunately. But that morning, what happened was we had just experienced the first major contact of the war in a city called Nasiriyah. The Battle of Nasiriyah, and as we entered the city, we thought that it had been surrendered. We were ambushed, lost about 50 Marines. We were able to push through the city, and set up a defensive perimeter north of the city along what's called Highway 7, which was our main avenue of approach. And we had to stop because we'd outrun our supplies, and we hadn't eaten in about 2 days. So my guys were, you know, we were tired, you know, hungry, and really scared. So my guys were dug in, and so I got up out of my fighting hole that morning. I'll never forget, it was like about 5 in the morning, right before as the sun was starting to come up. And I got up, and I was walking the lines, checking all my guys, because they were all really scared and wanted to make sure they were okay. And as I looked up, I saw a small white car advancing toward our position along the highway from the north. And it was really advancing at a really fast pace. And so there were no vehicles on the road at this time. So I thought, well, they've packed this car with explosives. They're going to blow themselves up in our position. So I grabbed 3 of my guys, took off running toward the car to stop it. And I fired a warning shot across the hood, and finally the car stopped about 50 meters out. The driver jumped out, starts waving his arms frantically and sprinting at us. So now I think, you know, this guy has strapped a bomb to himself. He's going to blow himself up. So I'm yelling at him in Arabic to try to get him on the ground. He's not responding. So I raise my weapon thinking I'm going to have to take this guy out. And I look behind him, and I see a large black military truck roll up behind his little white car. 6 guys in black jump out, run up to his car, and start shooting into the car. So the man stopped dead in his tracks, started screaming, turned around, started racing back to the car. And that's when I realized what was happening. This guy was one of those poor Iraqi farmers who was just trying to escape across our lines with his family. So I yelled at my guys to take out the Fedayeen as I sprinted as fast as I could to try to get there and save this guy's family. But by the time I got there, it was too late. I looked in the passenger side. His wife had been shot in the face and in the chest. She was slumped over dead. In the back seat, he had a little infant baby girl who her arm had been shot off, and she'd been shot in the head. And he was cradling the body of his little 6-year-old daughter who had been shot in the stomach, and she was choking on her own blood. And this guy was, you know, this guy was beside himself. In 2 seconds, he lost everything in this world that he had. And so for the first time in the war, everything slowed down for me. You know, I didn't know what to do. For the first time, I put myself in this man's shoes. And I asked myself, you know, I live in a world of choices. You know, where do I want to go to school? What do I want to eat for breakfast? Where do I want my kids to grow up? What were this guy's choices when he woke up this morning? You know, he could watch his kids starve to death. He could strap a bomb to himself. He could make some desperate attempt to cross our lines, knowing the Fedayeen were right next door. He didn't have any choices. And in that moment, I had a real awakening. And I had a real burning anger that started growing in me. You know, it just wasn't fair. It wasn't fair that the GPS coordinates of this man's birthplace dictated what choices he had in this world. And in that moment, I vowed that I never wanted to see that look in another human being's eyes again. I wanted to dedicate my life to giving opportunity and meaningful choices to those who have none in some of the toughest, most hard-to-reach places in the world. And that moment was the beginning of my journey into this new work.
Thank you, Jake. That's quite a story, and I'm wondering, as long as we're back in that time frame, was it clear to you at that juncture? I mean, it sounds clear you were headed in a new direction. How did the clarity of what that direction should be? How did that start to happen or evolve for you? Was it a slow process, or was it a fairly dramatic and quick one?
That's a great question, Paul. And actually, sometimes I feel in life I have to be hit over the head several times to really understand truth, unfortunately. And I have to learn lessons the hard way. That was the beginning of an awakening inside of me that put me on this journey. It actually took about 2 more years before I really understood what I felt like I was created to kind of do. And so I ended up having several experiences after that. You know, seeing a look of absolute desperation on the faces of young men and oftentimes women who would strap a bomb themselves or who would pick up a weapon and try to come fight us. And I began to understand again and again, like, you know, many times it was not out of some kind of misplaced sense of hatred for the West. It was out of love for that little five-year-old son and three-year-old daughter at home that were starving to death. And as I saw this again and again, I just said, you know what, enough is enough. And I set my guys down on my team, and I had a conversation with them. And I was surprised, because what I found was many of them actually had the same revelation. Many of them had the same conclusions, that what we were seeing and the desperation that we were seeing in extreme poverty was really fueling the growth of a lot of the terrorist cells and insurgent movement that was allowing it to grow and have increased kind of evil and oppression. And I said, you know, I think maybe I can have even more of an impact in this war if I get out and I try to tackle this from a different flank, from a different angle, you know, by taking on what we began to see was the one of the root contributors to that kind of global instability, which is extreme poverty. So it took about another 2 years.
And the trajectory from there, I know you, it sounds like you sort of went back to, at some point after that 2 year period, you began to study at Stanford. And was that, at that point, was it fairly clear in your mind that you would be going down a road of trying to attack these root causes, particularly extreme poverty? Or at that juncture, were you still kind of looking for what solutions you could be part of?
Yeah, so what the kind of the journey, how it evolved, I made that decision, talked to my guys, they agreed with me, they were cheering me on. I got out of the Marine Corps with this burning passion to do something, and I quickly found out that I had no idea what I was doing. I was not a development economist. I had no Peace Corps experience, I had no international development experience. I had an engineering degree from the Naval Academy, which was, I don't want to say worthless, but pretty close to worthless in what I wanted to do. And so I decided, you know, I had given up everything to go on this path, and there was no turning back. I was 120% in. This was going to be my life. So I spent about a year and a half just researching the space. I did a lot of research on who are the major players in this sector trying to fight extreme poverty. I knew that extreme poverty was the root that I wanted to tackle, but I didn't understand it. I didn't understand the fact that I'd seen the impact of what it causes. I'd seen the repercussions of it, but I did not understand the factors that caused it. So I really wanted to study it. So I spent that year and a half trying to learn from other organizations, doing research, having tons of meetings and interviews, trying to figure out how to tackle this problem. And in the beginning, I didn't want to start something. I wanted to join other organizations. I wanted to join someone else who was already doing really great work in this fight. And so as I was doing my research, I applied to a lot of places to join them. But I quickly found out that nobody wanted to hire me. I wasn't the kind of individual they were looking for. I guess maybe my background wasn't the best for it. So I'm pretty entrepreneurial, and decided, you know what, I'll just build something myself. And once I came to that conclusion, you know, I thought to myself, I don't want to build a small project that is going to impact a couple people in a remote village. I had left everything that I knew in this world, and I wanted to make that count. I wanted to actually have an impact in this fight on a global scale. And I knew that to do that, I needed to be able to build a company that could actually scale globally. And so in order to accomplish that, I need to understand how to build a business, how to build a company, and decided to go to business school. And I looked around, and I decided to apply to Stanford and Harvard, and by some miracle got in, and decided to focus on Stanford because of their focus on social innovation and entrepreneurship. And a really amazing thing happened when I went there. You know, I went there to build this company, and with that sole focus in mind. And when I went, that kind of passion and fire that I had transferred to my classmates. About 30 of my classmates got involved, helped me build out different pieces of the model, the financial model, the business plan, marketing plan, the fundraising committee, our metric system. And about 6 faculty members at the Stanford Business School jumped in, provided seed funding and mentorship advice. And by the time I graduated in June of 2008, We had raised about $500,000 to launch the project, and then I graduated in June, September. By then, I hired a couple people that I'd been recruiting, and in September, I moved to a really remote area in Kenya, one of the poorest districts in Kenya, to launch what became the pilot project of Nuru International.
Wow. So one of my, not being an expert in this field myself, I would think one of the questions going into this, as you were kind of researching this whole issue before you went to Stanford, is, you know, my impression is that there are lots of programs, lots of efforts to deal with poverty. Mm-hmm. And so is one of the going in questions, what can I do that's new here? I mean, is it working? And if not, right, what needs to change?
Right. Yeah, that was a big question that I had as well. You know, as I began to do my research, I began to learn a lot. And, you know, let me caveat this conversation by also saying that I by no means think that I'm an expert. I don't have even half of the equation figured out right now. I'm always learning, and so is my team, and we're committed to learning from others out there. There's a lot of people who are more brave, more courageous, more intelligent than we will ever be that have done amazing work in this field, and we try to learn from them all the time. But as I was doing my research, I began to see that there are some real, what I perceived as real gaps in the market. And there are a couple of them, were really fundamental, I think, to the space. And perhaps one of the reasons I might have been able to identify these, and others I'm sure have also identified this, is because I just had such a different perspective coming in. You know, my background is not exactly traditional for this work. And so I had a different perspective as I approached the problem. And so a couple key insights, two main ones that I had that I thought could be helpful is, number one, the actual definition of extreme poverty. Let's define the problem again. Let's redefine the problem. Because I think, you know, how you define a problem, how you define the issue really shapes the solutions that you build. And I thought that is something that we could use a little work on. So in my research, I found that I came across the work of a man I'm sure all of you are familiar with, Amartya Sen, and his work really inspired me, you know, because his definition of extreme poverty really began to match up with the realities that I had seen on the fields of combat and a lot of the desperately poor people that we had encountered. You know, the World Bank, the classic definition that I had come across, the World Bank defines extreme poverty as those living on less than $1.25 a day. But what I saw in my research again and again, and in my early days of the work, was that this definition of poverty, of extreme poverty, really led to material-based solutions that simply didn't last. There was a lot more to it than just economics. This is not just about income. And then when I came across the work of Amartya Sen and another man named Makhbul Belhaq, I began to see that these guys were saying that extreme poverty is really about a lack of meaningful choices for basic human rights. That now this is something that really resonated with me, because this was, again, lined up with the experience that I had had in combat in other places. And I thought, you know, if you tackle the problem with this as your definition, this is your root challenge, your root issue, then the solutions that you build and the goals that you have when you're designing are actually very different. So that was the first kind of insight that we had began to build our model on. The second one was the concept of ending extreme poverty versus alleviating extreme poverty. I saw a lot of groups talking about alleviating extreme poverty, or talking about ending extreme poverty, but not really, their practical application didn't seem to match that mentality. And this is not, this is an overgeneralization. There's a lot, again, there are a lot of other organizations, I think, that line up really well with our philosophy, but I began to see that, you know, the aid industry, I saw a problem of a self-perpetuating mega giant industry that was built to kind of continue. I saw a lot of work to alleviate suffering. I didn't see a lot of individuals or organizations who were committed to actually ending the problem. And in our world today, we have the resources, we have the people to be able to actually end the problem. And so something I often tell people when I give talks is, you know, if Nuru International exists in 30 years, then I have failed my entire life's mission. Our job should be to work ourselves out of a job. This problem needs to be ended. And the world, the global community needs to come together and actually end this problem. We can do it in our generation. So those are two kind of key insights, I think, that we begin to build on.
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, in the sort of lead up to all this, you know, you talked about not being an expert and having to remain open to learning. And so there's an awful lot of humility in there. But that, you know, on the face of it might seem contrary to a goal so ambitious as ending extreme poverty. But I think we've all had experience with the, as you were describing, you know, institutions have a way of, once they are founded, of beginning to have as an objective simply the perpetuation of themselves. And so that really resonates with me. The idea of ending something is to say, we want to go out of business.
Right. I just think it's very important, you know, and I think that by defining that, by all of us coming together and saying that is the goal, I think we can really arrive there much more quickly together. And also, let me say too, our mission is to end extreme poverty in remote rural areas, but by no means do we think that we can do that alone. I don't think that Nuru International is going to bring about the end of extreme poverty alone. What we want to be is a catalyst for a movement to help bring an end to the problem. I think we're on to something, in my humble opinion, I think we're on to something really unique, a unique approach that can be adopted at scale by a lot of other organizations and governments that can really help bring about the end of this problem. We can't do it, certainly cannot do it alone. And we need many, many others to be able to get involved in this, to be able to solve this problem on a global scale. But it begins by having the right conversation, I think, at a global scale about ending the problem, not alleviating it.
Talk a little bit, Jake, about it sounds like you redefined the problem, and then you have a goal that is different than what you saw out there. Now, those are ends which are ambitious. And talk a little bit about the model itself. I mean, what did you begin to see needed to be done that really wasn't being done to tackle this problem?
Sure. So what we found is that this problem, in order to solve it, it's really about people. I saw a lot of innovators and programs in the space that would take prefabricated solutions into a region and kind of force-fit these solutions into that village, into that community, into that that region. And what we try to do instead is we start with the fundamental philosophy. We're all about leadership. The leadership capacity building and enabling is actually the fundamental. It's the foundation of everything in the Nuru model. And I'll get to the Nuru model in 1 second, but it's important to understand the philosophy on which our model is built. We believe that a strong Ethiopian woman who has the same skills that I have, same knowledge that I have, is far, far more capable of designing world-class solutions that are going to be able to scale effectively within her nation than I will ever be. And our goal is to tear down obstacles around that woman and equip her with the skills that she needs to be able to actually untap that potential and really take those solutions that she designs to scale. So that's the fundamental philosophy on which our model is built. The way our model works is there are two main components of the model. We have what we call our impact model, and then we have our sustainability engine. Our impact model looks like a lot of other organizations. So it's an integrated approach. There's a lot of other organizations out there that have an integrated approach, and integrated approaches make a lot of sense, you know, because if you just increase crop yields to fight hunger, the children in the home might still be dying from malaria or diarrhea, and therefore the family has to sell the grain from the yield of that season, and they're kind of back down into the poverty trap again. There's many complicated factors if you just focus on a siloed solution that trap families in that extreme poverty, impoverished condition. So integrated approaches make sense, but no one's really built a model an integrated approach that can truly be self-sustaining and self-scaling. And that's really where our IP is. So our impact programs, our impact model is focuses on four areas of need: hunger, the inability of families to cope with economic shocks, unnecessary disease and death, and then child literacy. So those are the four needs that we focus on in our integrated approach. But the real key to what we do is our sustainability engine. We have two main components in the sustainability engine, because we believe that every organization, every company needs two fuels to grow and scale and sustain itself, and that's leaders and capital. So on the first component, for capital, we've actually built a separate for-profit company called New Ridge Social Enterprises. That for-profit company maintains a majority ownership position in a for-profit company that we build in each country. So take Kenya, for instance. We built a for-profit company in Kenya that's a diversified, scalable business. It has four business lines: poultry, dairy, consumer products, and agribusiness division. And as this company grows to profitability, it's legally structured so that those profits then have to be diverted back in to the nonprofit side to sustain the operations of the nonprofit, of the integrated approach, and also scale that approach throughout the entire country, independent of donations and philanthropy. Because we feel at the end of the day, philanthropy, we can't keep dumping, trillions of dollars in philanthropy into a nation. That the nation needs to fuel its own growth through capital generated in those markets. So that's the financial sustainability piece of our engine.
Mm-hmm.
The second piece of our sustainability engine is our leadership capacity building. So I mentioned we focus on leadership. We have developed a philosophy, and a curriculum, a unique curriculum, that takes local and national leaders to be able to equip them to understand needs in their region, to be able to design world-class solutions to meet those needs in those four areas of need that we focus on, to be able to implement and scale those solutions using really effective project management skills and business skills, and then to be able to innovate past challenges on their own after we exit using design thinking methodology. By doing this, the leaders that we equip are able to design the solutions with us. They build the programs with us side by side, so that when these programs break as they begin to scale, they know how to fix them because they helped build them. And in fact, they're going to fix them far better than we ever could.
Yeah.
New International's goal is to exit within 7 years from our country project, leaving behind a completely self-sustained, self-scaling national entity on the nonprofit side and a for-profit company as well that's fueling the growth of that nonprofit.
Impressive. So let me pick one piece of that seems particularly interesting. What is leadership in rural Ethiopia or rural Kenya? What does it look like? What have you learned in the process of identifying leadership? Is it obvious? Is it culturally challenging to really detect and nurture leadership? How do you go about that? It seems more like an art than a science.
Hmm. Yeah. Well. So my whole adult life has been about leadership, and because of that, I've made so many mistakes. I've made a ton of mistakes in leadership, but kind of along the way, I've learned a lot of lessons from that. I think the most important lesson I've learned is the most powerful form of leadership I've ever come across is a form of leadership called servant leadership. That form of leadership, I have found to work really, really effectively in every context I've come across. Whether it's in rural Africa, on the combat fields of combat, in the corporate setting, even on the athletic field, servant leadership is a really powerful form of leadership. So That's the form of leadership that we actually seek out and train to, number one. Number two, identifying those leaders is challenging, right? So there's many different challenges and reasons for that. We have two different main tiers of leadership that we work with. The first tier is like the senior level management, those that are able to actually run the company and scale it over time. And then you have the community-facing roles as well. Those who are going to be working in the villages, going house to house, working with farmers. Mm-hmm. At the senior level, we do just like you would in any company, and anywhere around the world. We do a nationwide search to find top talent in that country that's qualified, has a certain skill set that can, they can bring to bear to help grow the organization. But then we have a really unique onboarding process and screening process to ensure that the leaders that are coming to work with us can demonstrate that servant leadership mentality, that understand that at a fundamental level and have a civic-minded attitude toward development. That it's not just a profession, it's not just a business to them or a career where they're going to make money, but they have a true heart and passion for their people and their nation and a vision to end the suffering of their people. So through that screening process, we identify those folks, we bring them on. There's a probationary period where they have to prove themselves. A lot of that has to do with field work, how they interact with the farmers during the field work. And then they come and they take their positions, and then they're trained through our leadership program over the full 7 years that we're actually there. There's a whole pipeline of training that gets them prepared before we exit. The community-facing individuals, leaders, are actually more difficult. And the reason for that is when you go, we believe that the community-facing leaders need to come from that area, need to come from that region, because there's already a really strong bond of trust there in working mm-hmm. with the farmers. Mm-hmm. The challenge with that, though, is that many of the leaders who, the quote-unquote leaders, who are in those positions of power or authority are the wrong people to work with. You know, when you, what we found is, you know, you go and you have a leaders meeting of the leaders in the region, and the folks that come are those that, you know, speak a little bit of English, who the government and other NGOs have been working with kind of over the decades. Uh-huh. And many times those individuals actually want to take whatever you have and leverage it for their own gain. Yeah. And which is understandable because many NGOs, they come, they go. There's a lot of handouts that happen, and so it's built this kind of crippling dependency. So we have to kind of shatter that. So what we do in our meetings is we basically say, yes, we're here to really try to understand the need in this region, to understand what affects poverty in these communities. We're looking for volunteers. There's not going to be a salary. There's not going to be any program design for a long time. Like, we really just want to try to understand the need. There's not going to be handouts. And so when you say these things, you actually lose like 80% of the people in the room. And the 20% that are left, we go to them and we begin to work with them and say, you know, could you take us to the field and begin talking with some of the farmers? And so we go to the field and ask the farmers, you know, when times are tough, when times are difficult, who are some of the people in this community that you look to who have really helped you back on your feet? When there's a drought, when you lose a child, who helps you get back up on your feet? And they point us, we don't even use the word leader because it has a lot of baggage in many cases. They point mm-hmm. us to the true leaders, the true servant leaders in that community. And then we go to those folks and recruit them. And many times at the beginning, they don't want to work with us because, again, they've seen Western agencies come and go, and many of them have created, you know, that bad dependency that they don't want in their communities. So it then becomes a strategy of tearing down that the differences between, you know, me as the Westerner coming into work and the local leader trying to help their community out. It becomes mm-hmm. a strategy of building that trust up to where we can work together to design a common solution. There's a lot of strategies that we have to do that, mostly that involve, we can't act like we are the savior or answer to all these problems, because we're not. You know, instead, like for instance at NURA, we don't have SUVs, we don't have a lot of the shiny gadgets. We integrate into the community. You know, when I was working in Kenya, I have like an hour and a half walk to work every day. You know, the farmers uh-huh. see me walking, you know, with them in their fields. Uh-huh. If there's a meeting, a farmer training, and there's 100 farmers in the room, and there's 10 seats. Me and my staff, we don't sit in the seats. We sit in the mud and have the farmers, the older farmers, sit in the chairs. Or when the fertilizer truck comes up to offload, we don't sit there ticking boxes on a clipboard and while the farmers offload the fertilizer. We get up in the truck and we offload the fertilizer. So these are really basic you know, principles, but they have huge impact in building trust and buy-in with the local leaders that we're looking to work with, because it's all about partnership, and it's not the farmers that we're working with are not beneficiaries. They're partners. Yeah. In the solution design. And that's it starts with a philosophy, you know.
That sounds brilliant. I mean, in a sense, you want, I mean, as an organization, you want the kind of people most that don't really want to work with you. I mean, so you have to get over that threshold of here's yet another nonprofit or NGO is here to help us, and they know what that's about, and so you have
right.
to you have to connect with them on a really a different level.
Right. That's right. You have to get to the point where they will they'll tell you that you're ugly. You know, so when I walk through the field with my farmers now, it's really great because they're busting my chops and making fun of me. You know, it's a really great relationship, just like I would with my closest friends. You know, many times organizations suffer because the community tells them exactly what they want to hear. They won't
You're
tell
right.
them what their real problems are because they're afraid that they'll leave and they'll lose out on whatever they have to give. We destroy that so that it's a really genuine relationship.
Jake, do you think you can, I don't know whether this has come up, but can you teach servant leadership?
Absolutely. You know, and the reason I say that is because, you know, I'm not a good servant leader. I'm always learning how to be a better servant leader. And I do that by watching good servant leaders and how they operate, you know, and how they effectively lead people. Servant leadership is definitely something you learn. You know, there's leadership is there are certainly individuals who are naturally born with and gifted with certain traits that make them a more effective leader without trying very hard.
Mm-hmm.
But and those we typically try to seek out and work with those individuals the most because the cost of equipping and training those individuals is less. But you know, you can train and equip those who are not naturally gifted with those abilities to be able to do that. And the reason for that is because the principles of servant leadership are very simple. You know, it's around behavior change and action. And so as an example, like, the, you know, some of the key tenets of servant leadership that we teach are, you know, be humble. Admit when you're, you know, as part of humility, admit when you're making mistakes, apologize to your team, you know, be transparent. You know, that's the first thing. Second thing is be authentic. You know, be real, be with them, be yourself as a leader. Next is lead from the front and lead by example. Never ask your people to do something that you wouldn't do yourself. Get your hands dirty. Lead from the front. Next is lead with vision. You know, have a vision, be able to cast that vision and direction for your team so everyone is on the same track, moving in the same direction with the same motivation and inspiration. You know, and the last thing, general principle, is know three things really well as a leader. Know yourself really well, what are your strengths and weaknesses, and admit those. Number two, know your people. You know their families, what are their kids' names, their spouses' names, what inspires them, what are their dreams and hopes. And the last one is know your job really well. Be very, very good at what you do as a leader. You know, be competent. So these are all principles that anyone can learn. Anyone mm-hmm. can practice, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of our curriculum is designed around helping people to be able to and with behavior change to be able to adopt these principles as a leader.
You know, Jake, a lot of what comes through in your conversation, which I think is so admirable, is the transparency and the sort of humility to say you're a constant learner. And I've also noticed that you've been very upfront about mistakes made. So, just sort of generally talk about your relationship with failures. How important is that?
Mm-hmm. So that's a great question. Failure is vital. Actually, one of our core values as an organization is fail fast, learn faster. We think that, and I actually train my leaders and my managers in these principles. I tell them, you should expect your people to fail. You should give them enough room to fail because only out of failure can we learn how to grow as leaders. Can we learn how to design real solutions? If you build a culture where failure is not accepted, people will not take risk. And when you're trying to take on a challenge and a problem like extreme poverty, you have to be willing to, your people have to be willing to take risks. They have to be able to be willing to try new ideas where there might be failure. People have to be willing to operate on the 70% solution, not the 100% solution all the time. So failure is very, very important. And I, as a leader and our organization as well, have failed many times. And what we try to do is document our failures. You know, document our failures and learn from them, because learning from failure is absolutely critical. Otherwise, the failure is pointless. It's a waste,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
so documenting those failures, being very transparent about them, talking to our investors about them, talking to our stakeholders about them, and then learning from them and not repeating them. You know, very basic principles, but it's really, really important. You know, I think we, some of the key things that we've learned in the past is not to invest in a lot of infrastructure. Not that, you know, that you have to work with government at some level to make sure, you know, we made the mistake early on to try to stay off the radar from the government and not work with them, and just we wanted to do a grassroots approach that actually formed a parallel system to the government in many ways, and that was horrible. You know, the government, you know, just shuts you down. You become competition for them. So mm-hmm. we learned a lot about working with government, you know, like even governments that are not that great, you can find ways to align yourself with incentives and programs that they already have in place to make them essentially look good. And what I always tell government officials is, look, we don't care who gets the credit for this. You guys can take all the credit. Just don't put obstacles in our way, and we're mm-hmm. actually going to – our programs will make you look good. You know, so
I'm sure they like to hear that.
Yeah, it's been pretty effective in many places. But failure is important.
Do you have to convey a similar message to donors that, I mean, who may be involved for different reasons, just as a government might be, or is that a different relationship?
So our donor base is really interesting. So, you know, our idea, the model was really kind of born out of the Stanford Business School, and so kind of by chance and by that network. And you'll hear me call our donors investors. I actually don't say donors, because I believe that we've built a business, and we use business practices and business approaches to this problem to be efficient, to leverage every dollar that we have as far as we can to create the greatest amount of impact in an efficient way. And so I talk about our donors as investors. They're investing mm-hmm. that capital to create the greatest change that's possible. So a lot of our investors in the beginning, and even now, came from Silicon Valley, came from the finance market in Manhattan, the finance industry. So we have a lot of venture capitalists, a lot of hedge fund managers. We have a lot of entrepreneurs who sold their companies or are in the process of taking their company public. It's a mindset where many of our investors are looking for the next kind of big thing to be able to create
right.
social impact, and they're willing uh-huh. to take on risk. We found that our investors don't mind taking risks. They understand risk because many of them made money in the tech markets, you know. So they invest in 10 different things, hoping that they'll have the one Facebook, right? So we've had a lot of success recruiting that type of capital because they see us as a high. The upside is very, very big. You know, we've had a lot of our investors talking about, you know, if this thing works, it could really change the way the world fights extreme poverty. And mm-hmm. so they're willing to invest in that. A lot of the traditional foundations and kind of the aid industry and mm-hmm. governments are not willing to invest in us because our idea is a new approach. It does not have years of data behind it right now. And so they're unwilling to take that risk. So all of our capital has come from individuals to date, with a couple minor exceptions, but mostly from that type of person.
Sorry to interrupt, Paul. This is a fascinating conversation. I'm just going to open the Q&A session so that if people have questions, just hit *6 and you will be put in the queue. And Paul, you can continue with your question. I just want to make sure people get the opportunity to hit *6 and join the queue.
Yes, and I'll probably finish off with a question here because I'm sure there are going to be people who want to talk directly with Jake. So last question, Jake, might be, you mentioned early on in this dramatic experience in Iraq, you described that sensation as, you know, anger, a part of that. And I'm wondering how that has played out in all that you've done since then, whether that is a positive energy, emotion you can still work with, or whether it's it's transmorphed itself into something else?
That's a great question. I think you know, the anger about the injustice and inequality that I saw again and again was the thing that initially fueled me. But anger is not something that can build lasting positive. I don't believe something that can build lasting positive results in the world today. And what I saw over time is that that anger began to change. That motivation began to change really to a core love. You know, I'm a person of faith. My faith is the most important thing to me. I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and I believe that showing people the love of God in a very actionable way, in helping to provide those meaningful choices, is a way I could line up myself with the terrible suffering and evil and lack of equity in what I saw in extreme poverty. I could take that anger and I could turn it into something positive as a force of love for loving other people and really wanting to show that love in a very action-oriented way. Because, you know, the truth is I go to bed every night and I see the eyes of that man on Highway 7 when I close my eyes, and it just doesn't go away. You know, I don't want to see that in another human being ever again. And I will live my, you know, all my days will be spent trying to prevent that kind of inequality, that kind of lack of choices from happening again. So really it's that love for that man as well, you know, multiplied by millions that motivates me.
That's fascinating. Thank you so much, Jake.
There's a phrase, swords to plowshares, Jake, which comes to mind, which seems to me very much what you're about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I actually had a question. I was just wondering, is your model scalable in places where I know that a lot of countries in Africa, the problems are not the lack of resources, but the politics or the problems with the government. And I was just wondering, how do you, or maybe using the local resources, then you establish your company, that's kind of, but I'm sure they face the same problems. I'm just curious around that. How do you kind of?
No, absolutely. You know, that's a great question. That also brings up the question of, like, why do we choose Kenya and Ethiopia to start in when this vision and idea and model was born out of combat in failed states? We actually want to take our I have a passion and vision to take this model in the toughest places in the world. So we want to be in failed states and conflict zones. But the model is a very different approach, and so I wanted to prove it in a relatively politically stable area first, before we took it to a failed state and conflict or a conflict zone and introduced that level of volatility. We're building out a strategy to be able to do that. Our third country will be a failed state, but we want to finish proving the model first, which will take another year and a half to 2 years for completion in Kenya and Ethiopia. And at that point, we'll be addressing a lot of the volatility factors, such as lack of governance and you know, violence, militias, those issues that disrupt both development work but also the markets. So, and we've got some strategies that we're working on to address those issues, but it's much more complex. So what we're trying to do is take the basic model. Everything that we do, scalability is actually one of our core values as well. Everything that we design for scale. So our approach is really a framework that can be adopted and adapted in almost any context. And so we're designing for a framework that could also work in a failed state. One of the things that we're looking at for our for-profit side, for our new social enterprises side of what we do, is as we go into a failed state, such as an example like DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, if we were to do a project in DRC, we could do a project in North Kivu in the eastern Congo, and then we could actually set up our new social enterprises, the for-profit company, across the border in Uganda or Rwanda. and then be able to use funnel the funding across the border into the project that way, so we can actually build the business in a market that is more stable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah.
Michelle?
Hi, this is Michelle again.
Hi, Michelle.
Excuse me. So thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Again, I grew up in Zambia and Central Africa and have worked with people there. And now I'm later stages of my life and somewhat incapacitated physically, so I don't have the opportunity to get on the ground or the capacity the way you're doing, and I just thank you for that. I've sort of switched gears into spending my energies at a more intellectual and conceptual and global framework level, since that's what I still can do. And I have a couple of questions. One, just to clarify a little bit, something you said in using the word investors rather than donors, are investors getting a financial return on this project?
That's a great question. It's confusing to our donors sometimes, but I the way I clarify it is, right now all of our capital that we get is philanthropic. There's no financial return. Eventually that could change. So through our Nuru Social Enterprises strategy, those for-profit companies are throwing off enough profit to run the nonprofit side in country. But the way we've actually structured ourselves legally is we have a for-profit holding company that's a wholly owned subsidiary of Nuru International, the 501c3. That holding company is the one that maintains the majority ownership position of every company on the ground. So eventually, as we launch more companies and they become more profitable, I would like to see a dividend come back up to even pay for the 501c3 to make it self-sustaining so that we're no longer reliant on donations. At that point, we could be an attractive option for not only impact investors, but also, you know, you could use even the big pension funds, like CalPERS as an example, that could invest in Nuru International and expect a below market, you know, 3 to 5% return on that investment. And also, at the same time, transform a nation. You know, so that's kind of long term. That's like the 15, 20 year vision.
May I have permission to question you on that?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Given the perspective that I've had in working in many different countries around the world, I will ask you to question any model that ends up with scarce resources moving from a resource scarce place to a resource rich place.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a highly questionable model from my perspective, looking at the global systems mm-hmm. where we have such an imbalance. So anything that takes money out of Africa and pumps it into the U.S., no matter what happens in the middle, I question. Just food for thought.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And by the way, if you ever would like to have a conversation with me, I'd love to talk to you and share what I know and learn more about what you're doing and see how I can support you. The other question... Two other pieces of a related question is how are you – you talked about needing to work with the government. I also heard you talking about that you're not getting support from the development community. What are you doing to be partners with the development community since they are your allies? And how do you see you building connections with that group
sure.
and that community to support you? And then the other piece was how do you see, I'm working at the global level now in the global conversation, and I'm seeing the conversation of the sustainable development goals that will be ratified in 2015 as an opportunity for a unified human conversation to end poverty. And by the way, one of the changes is that they are talking about ending poverty, as you talked about it, rather than alleviating it, but actually ending it. And how do you see that might be useful in what you're doing? Or how you might connect with that.
Absolutely. We would love to plug into the global conversation, and that's actually part of what I'm doing back from Africa right now. I've been living in Africa for the last 6 years, and the next few months I'll actually be out of Africa trying to raise awareness about what we're doing because we do want to be part of that global conversation to be able to work together with much larger entities. The challenge for us is that no one knows who we are right now. And that's because I've been living in the bush for the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we definitely want to be a part of that larger conversation. When I say we're not partnering with any of the global partners, that's true, and it's mainly because they don't know us. We have a lot of partners at the micro level, so a lot of social entrepreneurs I work with, learn from, partner with. We call them mainly thought partners. So, you know, I talk about our impact model that focuses on agriculture, health, education, and economic development. We don't see any need to reinvent the wheel or duplicate effort. We actually take ideas from other organizations. As we design solutions with our leaders on the ground, our national leaders, we actually look at case studies of other organizations that are already doing really good, effective, sustainable, and scalable work in each of those four sectors. And we take their ideas and their models, and we adopt them and adapt them, making a composite within that region that will work specifically tailored for that region. And we, I have a lot of relationships with those founders and entrepreneurs that are running those companies. We have a lot of kind of lessons learned and sharing of ideas, both in, dedicated summits, and externships, and internships across the organizations, and sharing data. We're all about partnership. And again, as I mentioned before, we totally understand that we're not going to solve this problem alone. There's a much larger conversation that's happening. We want to be part of that conversation. We're just hoping to help shape that conversation some as well.
Great. So I'd recommend getting in touch with the Sustainable Development Solutions Network that Jeffrey Sachs is setting up, working with the United Nations in actually developing the Sustainable Development Goals, and I'd be happy to help connect you further if you're interested.
That'd be great.
And then I'd just like to profoundly acknowledge you for the depth of what you're doing and being able to look at the strategic end, at the high-end side, as well as I was very moved by your talk about actually connecting with the people that you're working with on the ground. I think that's absolutely critical and shows the heart and, there are many people that will go to Africa and see an African, and the Africans will see an American or a Westerner, and there's a barrier that's never broken, and it's clear that you break that barrier, and it's the core of what you do. And to be able to be working at that level and hold the high strategic end at the same time and working both is a phenomenal capacity. I really acknowledge it for it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And thank you for your comments and feedback.
Mm.
Thank you, Michelle. So if anyone has a question, just hit *6 or send the question to ask@servicebase.org. I was wondering, Jake, if you have, so it's the model, I'm guessing, is scalable anywhere in the world, right? Like countries in like India or other places. So do you have any plans of actively expanding, or is it more like you want people to come up and kind of approach you and kind of learn? Is there some kind of training program for people who may want to get some training and go back and implement it in other places?
Sure. That's a great question. And that goes to what I call our path to scale. Mm-hmm. So I believe we have two strategies for path to scale. The first one is, because of my background and experiences of my life, we have a real passion, and I have a real passion and vision for some of the toughest places in the world to be able to take this model. So we want to work in places like, DRC, Qatar, South Sudan, Yemen, Afghanistan, Somalia. And that's where my focus and taking our team to be able to implement the model. However, there's another path to scale that's very important to us, because it will allow us to scale our impact even more quickly, which is, once we prove the model, we would love to take our approach and use a trainer of trainers model where we could actually work with governments or other large NGOs that already have a presence in multiple countries to be able to teach them what our model is and how to adapt our model to what they're doing to make what they're doing more sustainable and scalable, have greater impact, and also facilitate exit. I think that's one of the big our big initiatives that we're working toward, is to be able to scale through those two paths. So the failed state path, about direct implementation of new international of the model, and then the trainer strategy, where We'd love to be able to take and package our model and train other organizations and governments to be able to adopt our model at scale.
Mm, wonderful. Thank you, Jake.
Mm-hmm.
Pavi?
Hi, Jake. My name is Pavi, and it's been incredible listening to your story. And I had a question about, you know, can you speak a little bit about maybe a time when you felt really tested in this work and, you know, how you kind of met that maybe doubt or whatever, resistance or, you know, whatever else might have surfaced?
That's a great question. And as I'm sure you all have experienced some really tough times in this work as well. We all do. I can share one a particularly challenging week with you. The very first week that I took Nuru to Kenya, and I was just getting started, that week was a fairly tough week. Our hut got attacked by safari ants, black widows. We had an earthquake.
Oh my goodness.
I got malaria, and then I got struck by lightning, and it was all in the same week. So that was a pretty tough week. I'll be honest, like I kind of wanted to quit.
Kind of.
Yeah. The thing that motivated me was I talked to people about having kind of in their roots when they're trying to do a really, you know, kind of have an audacious goal or impossible task. Because I talk about having this like get out of bed motivating motivation, and what I mean by that is like I had that horrible week. I've had a lot of my friends die. You know, the farmers that I work with for stupid reasons, diarrhea, illness, some AIDS, whatever it might be, and you know, when you have those experiences, you just don't want to get out of bed. You just want to give up.
Yeah.
But you have to have that thing inside you that really drives you and makes you get out of bed every day, you know, no matter what happens. And for me, it's two main things. One is remembering that look in that man's eyes and his desperation and helplessness. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is my faith. It's this concept of love, you know, that I feel like that God has for me, and how lucky I have been to be able to experience that and have as many choices as I have in my life, and to be able to share that, I think, to those who have been given much, much is required. And so that those two things really motivate me. And in that moment, after that really horrible week, my Kenyan partner, a man named Philip Mahochi, who actually just passed this year, he kind of set me down and said, you know, he was my first real coach and mentor. And he said, you know, you have to, when you have times like this, remember that this is one bad week for you. Many of the folks that we work with every week, they have these experiences every month, every week, you know, sometimes daily.
Yeah.
And yet they keep pushing, you know, yet they survive. And so remember that when you have these challenging times. And it really moved me. You know, it helped me set things in perspective. You know, I had one bad week. I mean, granted, it was a really bad week, but I had one bad week, and a lot of the farmers that I was working with faced challenges just a tougher on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Alan?
Yes, I was wondering, you talk about going into the conflict zones, and these people are in control of that situation or that place, and a lot of times it seems like they want bribes or things like that. How are you planning to deal with that?
Sure. Well, number one, I'll tell you that we definitely don't have all the answers figured out. There's a lot of unknowns about going into the failed state and conflict zones regions. We have a lot of strategies that we want to pilot, but we definitely don't have all the answers yet. One approach that has worked for us in specifically around the bribes is, you know, Kenya really struggles. A lot of organizations, including us, really struggle with this problem in Kenya. There are difficult challenges of corruption in Kenya, as many of you know who work in Kenya. And what in the early days, we had a lot of problems with, especially at a regional level, of government officials asking for bribes, and if you don't bribe them, they would throw up obstacles. So what we have this kind of design thinking mentality of trying to always think outside the box and develop empathy for those that we're working with to try to understand how to meet their needs and still accomplish our goals. We don't bribe, and we feel like that actually creates greater dependency, and that's one of the root problems is that many NGOs, particularly in Kenya, I can speak to, have done bribery for a long time, and because of that, many government officials' salaries, especially at the lower levels, are actually decreased because they know that they're going to be getting bribes as almost part of their salary. So it makes operating in that area very difficult. So what we do instead, as I kind of alluded to before, is, and I can mention one concrete example, with the Ministry of Health, when we were starting to work with our health worker model, in Kenya, the Ministry of Health has to give you a stamp of approval on your health worker group that you're working with, and they have to go through a kind of mandated training. And that training, there was a USAID project in the area that had been doing health worker models for a while, and they had been paying the government about 2 million shillings for each health worker group that was registered. And when we went into actually implement our model, we obviously couldn't afford 2 million shillings. So we worked with the government and tried to, basically pulled out the line items to understand what the budget was for, and just a lot of it was fluff. What we really needed was, it was about 115,000 shillings that was needed. The rest of it, honestly, was a bribe. So I pulled their development plan off the shelf and kind of opened it up and went through the target goals that they needed to hit for their health worker groups in Nyanza province in that region. And I said, we will help you hit these. Our model's designed already to help increase the indicators in all these areas. We're actually going to help you hit these, and in a way that you can't do right now. You're failing in these areas. Here's your current metrics. Here's what we're going to be able to do for them. And we don't want any of the credit. You guys can take the credit. You'll get promoted. You become the shining stars of Nyanza province, and you'll get more aid funding into this region. Just let us do our work. And so then, after that conversation, they let us register our health worker group for 115,000 shillings. So sometimes for us, it's about trying to find creative ways to, again, kind of align, understand the needs of the individuals that you're working with in the government, and trying to creatively align incentives without compromising your philosophies or your model.
Cool. Thank you so much, Rick. This is the question we ask all our guests who are doing work like what you're doing. What is it that we as a community can do to support you and your work?
Well, thank you for asking that. It's wonderful. I think, again, I said that I'm back out of Africa now into the West for two main reasons. The first is we are about 5 years into our 7-year proof of concept of the model, and we need to get through that proof of concept to begin really scaling our approach. So we need two main things to make that happen. The first, as I'm sure you know, is capital, mm-hmm. and the second is awareness. I mentioned no one really knows who we are right now, so any ideas that any of you have for new investors that could be interested in our approach, I would really appreciate any kind of references or introductions. That would be really helpful. And the second on the awareness piece, help us spread the word about what we're doing. I do a lot of speaking. I do a lot of kind of group discussions. So, and I'll be in the U.S. For the rest of the year, minus like one month in the fall. And I'd love to connect with any of you who have ideas on either of those two fronts.
Definitely. We'll be, as you might know, we'll be publishing a blog about this call and also posting the recording and spreading the word. And I'll send out, if you don't mind, your email.
That's great.
Yeah, to the people on the call. And so if they have some ideas, they can connect with you directly.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. This was a pleasure. I'm handing over to Paul if he has any closing comments before we close the call again with a minute of silence.
Thanks, Kanchan. Thank you, Jake. I think it's been a great conversation, very inspiring to all of us, and given me a lot to think about. And we just all hope we can continue to support you in any way that would be helpful.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you. So I would like to request a minute of silence in deep gratitude for all the wonderful work that Jake is doing, and keep your thoughts with all the people who maybe don't have all the possibilities that we do. So thank you again for joining, and I would like to request a minute of silence, after which I will unmute everyone, and then we can say a collective thank you to Jake. So a minute of silence. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. And at the count of three, we are all going to say thank you, Jake. Two, three.
Thank you, Jake.
Thank you so much.
Beautiful weekend.
Thank you all very much.
Thanks, Jake.
Thank you.
Thank you.